Hi, folks. This is CBD of the Cut Jib Newsletter Worldwide Podcasting Network. I'm here with JJ Sefton, my podcast and blogging partner. And we have a special guest today, Robert Spencer. Many of you know his name, so it doesn't really need an introduction. However, I am going to introduce him in one way, and that is perhaps the most important and impressive thing on his resume, on his curriculum vitae. And that is that the grooming capital of the world, Great Britain, grooming and anti-free speech capital of the world, really, at this moment, has seen fit to ask him not to return, which I think is more than anything else a very, very impressive thing to be said about a human being. Anybody who pisses off the UK enough to be asked not to return is a good man in my book. Anyway, Robert, how are you doing?
Just great, thank you. And thanks for having me on again. It's good to talk to you guys again.
Absolutely. And for those who are unaware, Robert Spencer runs and founded a wonderful blog and is probably one of the most preeminent experts on the current situation vis-a-vis Islam in the world, also historical Islam. And he runs a site called jihadwatch.org, if I'm not mistaken. And he literally chronicles the oceans of blood spilled in the name of that quote unquote religion. And he's also a prolific author and essayist. His many writings I link to all the time are can be found at the Invaluable Front Page Mag and in many other places. So welcome aboard, sir. And I'll let CBD take it away.
So the impetus obviously is the resurgence of militant Islam, although that's a misnomer. It is in fact Islam over the last probably year or two, and it's an unfortunate coincidence that that Robert is also publishing a book about anti-Semitism called Anti-Semitism: History and Myth. It's coming out in a week or two. And that's a good segue into exactly what is going on in Gaza and Yemen and Lebanon and the disputed territories, although they're not disputed in my book, and Iran. Perhaps Robert will correct me, but is this a resurgence of the violent aspect of Islam?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's a resurgence, but it has to be remembered that it never really goes away. There has never been a large-scale reconsideration of Islamic theology, a reformation, some kind of a retraction. People don't realize. They read about the Islamic Jihad conquests in history, and they think, well, all that is a long time ago, and now things have changed. That's not actually the case. Islamic theology is the same as it's always been, and it mandates warfare against unbelievers and their subjugation under the rule of Islamic law. And consequently, to talk about a resurgence is only to talk about a new opportunity that they're taking advantage of, not a change of heart or some innovation or something new or a revival of something old. It's always there. But nowadays, because they perceive that the West is weak, they are growing more assertive on a number of fronts. And so you see the mass migration into Europe, the steady drumbeat of news out of Europe, out of Germany, France, Britain, and Sweden in particular, about random stabbing attacks on the street, vehicular attacks, these kinds of things happening on a more or less regular basis. And that's all just designed to weaken the central government and law enforcement authorities so that they'll ultimately collapse and eventually be replaced by an Islamic state. And of course, Europe is just one part of the whole picture.
I watched a YouTube video, short video. It was a pro-Western video, and it had a list of the major UK cities whose mayors are Muslim, and it was shocking how many there were. And this is exactly the way they work. And they, I sound like a jingoistic racist, but I'm not. It is they and us, and we have to figure out who is going to run the world at this point. But that technique of taking over the political process in small towns up to London, England, by the way, is governed by a Muslim man. It's shocking because clearly, militarily, Islam cannot compete with the West, and they have not been able to compete with the West for a very, very long time. But it's not just the military; it's demographics, and it is political strength and the ability to organize and focus on one goal. And that goal is very, very obvious nowadays.
CBD, it's a very important point that you made actually just in passing by saying, well, I sound like a jingoistic racist, but I'm not. This is a very important thing to dwell on for a minute. And that is because in the West, we have been taught now, we were all taught when we were young, and generations have been taught that to see the world with an us and them mentality is exactly what you said. It's jingoism, it's racism. We have to understand that we have a common humanity with everyone, and that we should be welcoming of migrants and so on and so on. And that's all very well. But the fact is that in the Islamic world, they never have taught this. And that in country after country, even in ones that are reputed to be moderate, like Turkey and so on, they teach the us and them mentality without apology and without equivocation. They teach that the world is divided between believers and unbelievers in Islam, and that the believers are superior to the unbelievers. And the Quran says Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Those who follow him are ruthless to unbelievers and merciful to one another. Now you have generations of young people being taught that kind of thing all over the countries that are dominated by Islam. And in the West, on the other hand, you have generations of young people who've been taught that it's racist to think that we are different from anybody else, that we might have some kind of a culture and way of life that's worth preserving, that there might be some reason why we might want to close our borders to any and all who might want to come in. That all these things are racist and to be rejected. Now, that's just setting up for a disaster because, as I said at the beginning, Islam has not reformed its doctrines of jihad, warfare against unbelievers. And there are going to be Muslims who pursue the impact, who pursue those doctrines, and that will have an impact on the West. Meanwhile, in the West, they all think that it's wrong, or many people think, although I think this is changing now, but we've all been taught that it's wrong to value our own culture, to value our way of life, and to think that we need to defend these things.
At the risk of turning this into a cheerleading session for Donald Trump, I think his re-election in 2024 sort of took the blinders off, or maybe allowed people to speak their minds about the glory of Western civilization, the glory of American exceptionalism, the glory of America. It is happening in the United States. Can it happen in the failing countries of the West? Can it happen in the UK? Can it happen in France? Can it happen in Germany? Can it happen to a lesser extent, Italy? Can it happen in Spain? Or are we just too far along to this into this postmodern malaise that everybody is better than we are and we should just slit our throats? Or allow
Well,
or to slit our throats?
there seems to be a, electorally, at least temporarily now, there seems to be a resurgence. I mean, whatever one thinks of what's going, what, the German elections and other parties, where people are opening their eyes to what mass migration and the swamping of indigenous culture means. And yes, it's the media in both foreign media press and also here is attacking it as racist and xenophobic and this and that and the other thing. And unfortunately, we have ourselves to blame for years and years and generations of, of so-called critical thinking and anti-racism and this and that, and constantly this constant drumbeat of, America's original sin of slavery and this and this. And it feeds into these notions that allow us to say we can't, we have to open our borders and we have to do this and we have to be critical of ourselves and we're the problem and it's not everybody else. And yes, whatever our problems may be, that doesn't excuse, rape gangs in Europe. And every time you even bring up the subject of this, which are a known fact, the grooming gangs, you're looked on as some sort of a freak or a racist who is to be shunned and censored, if not jailed. And, if we're going to do that, we're slitting our own throats, so to speak, and, or they're going to do the slitting for us. But yeah, we have, something has to be done. And I think in some quarters in European countries, they are waking up to it. But to your point, CBD, is it too little, too late? Who knows? I mean, until the knife is at your throat or until you're the one that's being, your daughter or your wife is being abused. I mean, who knows?
Well, that's Robert, the thing. It I'm is sorry. Very advanced. So you do have, you have Wilders in the Netherlands, who is not the prime minister, but he's essentially the controlling element of the governing coalition. And you have Meloni in Italy. You have Le Pen, who would probably win the next election in France, although, of course, there are a lot of variables. But if it were a free and fair election, if it's held without any significant change in the political environment, which, of course, could happen, then she will likely win. You have the AfD in Germany, which did very well in the last election, although not nearly enough, well enough to change the direction of the country. And you have the Sweden Democrats, who are a very good group that's part of the governing alliance in Sweden, although they've been sort of effectively neutralized by entering into the coalition. In any case, you do have, in other words, elements in all these countries where the crisis is very severe that want to reverse it and stop all this from happening. Now, the question is going to be, however, whether it's too late in a functional sense, because you have rapidly growing Muslim populations in all these countries. And where are they going to, what are they going to do? They're not going to go home. They were, it's been going on long enough now. These people were born in these countries, and consequently, they're there to stay, and that's going to be a situation that these countries are going to have to reckon with for generations, unless they undertake some program of mass deportation. But that seems impractical in the first place, because, like I say, you're talking about populations that were born in these countries. So where are they going to deport them to? And who's going to agree to take them? So you've got the core problem that you've got a demographic in these countries that is growing much faster than the native population. And so whether or not the situation is reversible at this time, I'm not going to say it's not, because history is full of surprises and any number of things might intervene. But right now, it looks like you're going to deal with Muslim populations that are the majority in many of these countries within a generation or two. And that, of course, is going to have transformative effects for those countries and for the world.
Has there been any country that has successfully integrated significant Muslim populations?
No, that's never happened in world history. And so anybody who thinks that's going to happen now is being naive, not only on the basis of 1400 years of experience, but also on the basis of the fact of Islamic theology, which is supremacist, aggressive, expansionist, violent, and intransigent, and does not allow for the idea that there could be a population of non-Muslims that is equal in rights and status with the Muslims in the society. And so it's just never going to happen. that you're going to have a society that a non-Muslim society that successfully integrates the Muslims. There are always going to be some of the Muslims who are working for the supremacy and hegemony of Islamic law. And so these the European countries have bought themselves a massive amount of strife in the years to come.
It will be interesting to see. I mean, mercifully, thankfully, we won't be alive to see it, but who knows? We may have a picture of it. If you can imagine in a couple of hundred years where, skilled workers, this is why they imported it, to where skilled people no longer exist, where practical subjects are no longer really being taught in schools, where there's no innovation, where there's no progress, and there's nobody to, to man the machines, so to speak, and to do the jobs that people normally do. And, while Western societies might collapse because of that, with a majority Muslim population, they too will collapse in and on themselves in 100 or 200 years, or who knows. It's really it's crazy when you try to game out the future, if we can game it out, as you say, Robert. We
I
never
think
know.
that's a yeah, that's an excellent point. And if you look at the oil-rich Gulf states, these are countries that are massively wealthy, and yet they have no homegrown engineers, they have no homegrown carpenters and masons and so on and so forth. They import a huge amount of their skilled labor, and and they have all the money in the world essentially, so they could be creating homegrown experts and homegrown professionals, and yet they don't. And now, is that a function of Islam? Is that a function of the sloth created by unlimited wealth? Is it, there are sociological reasons that I imagine people can explore. But I think that's a very, very interesting point. When the West falls, Islam will fall soon after, because they simply cannot maintain a technologically advanced world.
Well, this is actually, excuse me, this is actually the subject of a book that I've written. It won't be out for about a year, but I wrote it a few months ago, and it's about how Islam is a complete failure, both for individuals and societies. And one of the reasons is because it sets up a culture that is inherently parasitical. The idea in Islam is not to inculcate a work ethic. There is none of the value of work that is taken for granted on a wide scale in the West. The West speaks about labor as being something that is noble in itself. You know, this is one of the reasons why we have Labor Day. It came out of the struggles with socialism and communism, but there is a core to it that is not tainted, that has to do with the idea that labor is worthwhile, is valuable, is nothing to be ashamed of, that working is a good thing in itself. Now, this is a foreign idea in the Islamic world. The Islamic world, the Islamic law and Islamic theology set up a scenario in which the infidels work and the non-Muslims enjoy the fruit of their labors. This is the whole idea of dhimmitude, that the Quran stipulates that the non-Muslim must pay the jizya, the tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. And so the non-Muslim is supposed to work and hand over the tax to the Muslims. And the Muslims ideally would not work, but they would live off the fruit of the labors of the non-Muslims. And so this creates a society that is not self-sufficient. And so you look at the Ottoman Empire, for example, and the Ottoman Empire was the great power in the world at a time when it had wealthy Jewish and Christian communities that were paying large amounts of tax into the national treasury. And the government would then use those funds to fund jihad wars against Eastern Europe. And of course, we all know about the Gates of Vienna and all that, and the large Ottoman expansion into Europe. But that was all financed by the money of the non-Muslims. When those non-Muslim communities, however, were bled dry and became impoverished, Then the Muslims began to decline. The whole society began to go into decline because it did not have a viable work ethic of its own. And so, if the non-Muslims were not paying sufficient tax, then the Muslim economy went into the tank. And that's why the Ottoman Empire ultimately fell. So, you're talking about societies that can't sustain themselves. They depend upon jihad conquest of the unbeliever and then the subsequent exploitation of the unbeliever. And so you're very right when you say if the West falls, then the Islamic world does not long for this world because it doesn't have the wherewithal within itself to sustain itself.
Is that a I mean is that a cheerful and optimistic way of looking at the next 500 years?
Well, yeah, I think so. I won't be around
I don't know.
to collect all your plaudits when I turn out to be right. But yeah, I think that is the situation for the next 500 years.
Well, that gives me the opportunity for a segue, and that is the obvious question when people talk about Gaza is where would you rather live, Gaza City or Tel Aviv? And the expectation, of course, is that people in their hearts would say Tel Aviv because, it's not a savage place the way Gaza City is. But, the Arabs in Gaza had complete autonomy and they were getting the jizya from the UN and various non-governmental organizations and actually direct payments from many European and unfortunately North American countries to maintain their standards of living and increase their standards of living. And yet they spent, a huge portion of that money on building tunnels and creating the infrastructure to murder
If
1,200
you
people.
remember, the first thing that happened once Israel handed Gaza over to them in 2005, they were given, if I remember, hothouses and warehouses and farms and all of these
Yeah,
incredible
they were given
an industrial
a
base. They set fire to them and they destroyed them and they absolutely smashed them. So there you go.
lot of it was used as tunnels. They made the greenhouses into tunnels to smuggle weapons into Gaza. I mean, into Israel.
So, Robert, I would like to get your opinion about the various plans for either the reconstruction or the destruction of Gaza. Now, I realize that it's difficult to speak with any degree of accuracy right now because we simply don't know what's going to happen in Gaza. It is entirely possible that Israel is going to begin full-scale attacks on Gaza in the next week or two. Certainly, President Trump has given the green light. So, for all we know, Gaza will actually cease to exist in the next 6 months. But what do you think of the various plans for the, as I said, either reconstruction or the relocation of Gaza?
Well, I think that I really can't tell what's going on in Donald Trump's mind. And many people, of course, are ridiculing his talk about clearing out Gaza. And it's a bit ambiguous. He's been a bit ambiguous as to whether the people of Gaza would be allowed to return if they were to leave and under what circumstances they would that would happen. But I think that it's interesting that he has completely changed the discussion. And I do suspect that that was what he intended to do all along. That whether he really means to or thinks that it's possible to establish a Riviera in on the Mediterranean, which, I mean, of course, theoretically, it would be wonderful because Gaza was actually quite beautiful and there's no reason why that couldn't happen except for the jihad belief system. But the fact is that he's completely ruled out now the possibility of going back to the status quo ante that everybody was assuming. I think that if Kamala Harris were president right now, then she would be insisting that Israel simply acquiesce to Gaza taking control once again I mean, of Hamas taking control once again of Gaza and everything going on as it did before, with Gaza receiving the jizya, as you noted, from the United States and the EU and all the rest, and nothing changing. And Trump has now made it very clear that's one thing, whatever does happen, that's one thing that's not going to happen. Gaza is not going to go back to what it was before. And so we need to find some new way ahead. And what that will be, nobody knows, but I give him credit for going that far at least, instead of just as Harris would have done, reapplying the same failed solutions that are not solutions at all, again and again and again.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, it's the whole foggy bottom nonsense of, you know, of peace process boogaloo. That's all they want, just the process. And the only thing that gets processed are innocent lives, mostly and primarily Jewish, into a meat grinder. And that's it. They want Israel destroyed, and they want to replace Israel with Iran as the supreme, you know, the top dog in the Middle East. Nuclear weapons and all the rest that goes with it. To hell with Israel. That's what the left wanted, and that's what Foggy Bottom wanted. And you're right, Robert. At the very least, if Donald Trump just puts the issue out and shows the world what it is and who they're dealing with, that alone is, you know, why not?
And
So.
after all, come out now with DOGE cutting government waste, it has to be asked. You got to wonder, does Foggy Bottom want to keep reapplying these same failed solutions because they're getting kickbacks from all the aid? And I wouldn't be in the least surprised.
Nor would I. And I think that the political climate in Israel is going to change in the next few years because there is going to be less virulently anti-greater Israel sentiment funded by the various, you know, USAID and so on and so forth. And I think that that's going to change Israel. I'm hoping. Folks, I have very little data to back that up, but I am certainly hoping. Robert, I have a question about the tone of the education in Gaza. I mean, people, it's well documented that the entire educational apparatus in Gaza, and obviously the Palestinian Authority in the disputed territories of the West Bank, are focused primarily on demonizing Jews and Israel, and laying the groundwork for the destruction of Israel and the destruction of worldwide Judaism. It's rabid. It's insanity. You know, I've seen translations of texts for 5-year-olds. You look at it and you think this cannot be. You know, these people cannot be human. But how close to typical is that? Or is that the outlier in Islam in the world?
Unfortunately, it's quite typical. And one of the things that has not been addressed in all the controversy about the Gaza textbooks is that textbooks in the Islamic world generally run in that line. And especially in Egypt, which has an agreement, the Camp David Accords stipulate that Egypt is not going to allow any Semitic material to be spread. And it just routinely ignores that and violates it. And if you look at the Egyptian textbooks, they're not any different in the dissemination of hatred of the Jews and the determination to destroy Israel. And so ultimately, this comes down again to Islam and to aspects of the problem that nobody wants to deal with, that it is part of the Islamic faith that the Jews are the worst enemies of the Muslims. And so you're just not going to find material in the Islamic world that does not reflect that. And nobody in Washington has ever dealt with the implications of that. One of the oddest things about the conflict that I always point out, and I'm going to keep on pointing it out as long as I'm still speaking anywhere, is this, that if you look at the Palestinian Authority when they talk about Israel, and you look at Hamas when they talk about Israel, And if you look at all the communiques of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab League, when they talk about Israel, you will find universally that they all talk about Islam. That for ev in every one of these cases, it's all about Islam for them. And yet, if you look at the State Department, in what it says about the conflict, nothing about Islam ever shows up. It's never about Islam. It's just not. I don't think you would find a single State Department communique about the Arab-Israeli conflict that says anything about Islam. And so you've got a very anomalous situation. The one thing that one side says that it's all about, the other side steadfastly ignores. And that's just nuts. You're never going to get anywhere in dealing with this problem adequately if you don't deal with what the opposition actually says it's all about.
Well, when George W. Bush unilaterally declared after 9/11/01, with the ruins of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon still smoldering, saying we are not at war with Islam, this is a war on terrorism. At that point, you could have turned off your sets, ladies and gentlemen, and here we are, 24, 25 years later. Hey, look, we may not be at war with Islam, but they sure as hell are at war with us, and nobody wants to seem to recognize that. And to
Yes.
your point about what's being taught in the textbooks, and you're the, you know, I mean, I what I know about Islam is the that I know that, look, they the Quran and the Hadith and all of these writings are considered to be the actual words. Muhammad's words are words of God through him, and so you cannot change that. So if they're teaching in their schools that Jews are the descendants of pigs and apes and are to be liquidated, killed, and they are occupying our lands and they're whatever, then you can't tell them not to teach that, because that's telling them to blaspheme against their religion. So we're in a bit that there's your problem right there. And then, that's why they're never gonna, that's why this is never gonna, unfortunately, change unless and until, one side or the other disappears, or is made to disappear, or has a reformation, which is never going to happen.
That's why we have this ongoing dance that never ends, that
Yeah.
Palestinians or the Saudis or whoever, they pledge to reform their textbooks, and then the inspectors go back a year later and look at them, and everything's the same. And they're just the West persists in thinking this is some kind of anomalous extremism, which the good forces will ultimately root out. And the Islamic world continues to act upon its understanding that this is just basic Islam and they ain't never going to change it.
I think
So we always hear about
the
these
problem,
mythological moderate Muslims, and like we never see
yes,
them. Yeah,
but
they're
the
moderate in that they don't want to chop our heads off. They just want to give us, they just want to shoot us in the head quickly and get rid of us.
oh,
There's your moderate.
I think that's a very important point. There are moderate Muslims, but the thing is that their moderation is a little bit different than what we expect them to be. They are Yeah.
moderate in the sense that they do not want to kill us, but they are perfectly content for the less moderate Muslims to kill us. And that is
Yes.
the difference, I think. There are, the reformations, the Renaissance and the reformations that we went through in Europe, for several hundred years, changed the perspective of many, many people of essentially Western culture. And it changed it for the better. The problem is that the assumption that oh boy, I got to be careful here, but the assumption that all human beings have that spark in them is a very, very dangerous one. Because at the age of 2 years in Gaza, children are being taught to kill Jews. It's very difficult to fight that. In fact, I think it's impossible to fight that. And that's why the destruction of Gaza is probably going to be the only permanent solution. And if Robert is correct about worldwide Islam, and I have no reason to think that he isn't correct, he's obviously correct, then the issue is very, very serious. And I mean,
Well, yeah, you can
how
destroy
do you
Gaza, but
change?
that still
Yeah,
leaves over a billion Muslims in
exactly.
throughout the world.
Exactly. How do you change the educational system in Indonesia?
I mean, what, 150 million Muslims? I don't know how many people live in Indonesia, but they're mostly Muslim. How do you change the educational system in a country of 100 or 150 million people? How do you change the educational system across the 22 Arab states? How do you change the educational system in every single mosque and every single Muslim school in America and the UK and France and Sweden and so on? How do you do that? You can't. It has to be done by the Muslims. It has to be done by Islam, and there is no reason to expect any kind of renaissance in that religion and in that culture. And that's scary.
Yeah, there are moderate Muslims because, as in every religious group, there are some people who take it very seriously and some people who don't, people who have other priorities and other values, and some people who don't, and so on. But there is no moderate Islam. There is no version of Islam that doesn't teach warfare against unbelievers and the need to subjugate them. And so the West is just whistling in the dark because it assumes that the moderates are going to win out, and the moderates are never going to win out because they're always going to be vulnerable to challenge by the hardliners that they're not really being loyal to Islam.
Hoi. Yep. It's
So I just noticed something very interesting, and it's sort of symbolic of the lack of focus in the West. And that is, I actually saw it on Jihad Watch, Robert's organization and website. The front runner to replace Trudeau in Canada as the Liberal leader says that the UK nuclear forces can protect Canada from Donald Trump. Now, this is the kind of insanity that Western culture is immersed in, and yet they are completely unwilling to look at the reality of the situation, and that is what Robert has so ably described across the world. And until we smack these people in the head and say, stop thinking like a moron, focus on reality. This is the kind of stuff that we're going to be immersed in at the, at and we're going to be penalized every single day because the real problems will be ignored.
Well, just to segue into Robert's book on anti-Semitism, and this is reflective in the West of a very, I mean, the poor Bibas children, these wonderful little kids who were literally just buried. There are monuments to them and memorials being erected all over in the West, at least, that are being defaced, and they're being and there are certain people that are saying. That are saying we're only concerned about them because they're symbols of white supremacism because they have red hair. And I'm going, we're this is it, it's just you just shake your head. And then you look at what happens on campuses like Columbia University and elsewhere, Cal Poly and so on and so forth. Just and forget about the Muslim world. It's happening right here in our own, I mean, in the most Jewish city in the world outside of Israel, in New York City. It's like more anti-Semitic assaults and attacks than ever before. And it's like if you can't feel safe in New York City as a Jew, I mean, where can you feel safe? But this mentality of equating Israel and Jews, with white supremacy, with colonialism, with bigotry, and so on and so forth, is whatever will happen, and that's why they cheered when. When the Israeli babies were roasted alive in front of their parents, and when women were gang raped and taken into captivity.
It's
I'm sorry, go ahead, Robert.
that Marxism sees the world in terms of the oppressor and the oppressed. And of course, the universities and the whole intelligentsia in the West is Marxist. Although it's not generally acknowledged. And so they see the world in those terms, and consequently, they cast Israel in that same kind of light. And when you've cast Israel as the oppressor, then you can completely dehumanize them. And I mean, this is how Marxism works. And so any kind of compassion for even these little children is ruled out of bounds because they're the oppressor. And this coalesces 100% with the Islamic view that these are the worst enemies of the Muslims and are always scheming against the Muslims and have to be fought as a result. And so the left and their Islamic allies, they meet on the ground of anti-Semitism. And they both have their reasons for hating Israel and by extension hating Jews. And although those reasons are distinct, they work together very nicely, as we're seeing.
Well, they will work together very nicely until Islam is ascendant in the world, and then these ardent leftists will discover that
No matter how hard they flap
that
their arms, they're not going to be able to fly
they're not
off of
going to
the
fly,
Quran
and they're and they will be the next. They talk about first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people. Well, that then the progression will be first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people, then the Marxists, and
Oh,
it's
yeah.
very. And these people are feeding the crocodile, hoping that they are eaten last. And there's because listen, folks, just listen to what Robert has spoken about. There is no accommodation absent a massive reformation of Islam. There can be no accommodation. And the question before the West now is how to force moderation on Islam. When Islam doesn't want to be moderated. And that's a tough question. I don't know how it's going to be answered, but it's
Well,
going to be a
if there
very,
is a
very
Donald, if Donald Trump, I mean, I doubt he would ever do this because, I mean, it'd be amazing if he did, and he'd probably, I don't know if he'd survive it. If he can ask the question of whoever he meets, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or whatever Islamic leader he may happen to meet somewhere, and say, do you think the words in the Quran that equate Jews to pigs and gorillas, do you think that this is right? Don't you think that you should not teach this? Oh boy, can you imagine the reaction of the heads exploding there? But at least he'd bring it out in the open.
Yeah, but it's in the Quran, and so it ain't going anywhere.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
And that's and I'll say it again, folks, just listen to what Robert Spencer said. There is no moderation when it's a binary question. There cannot be moderation. And well, anyway, listen, we're getting more and more depressing as we go farther and farther into this podcast. I do want to mention again that this is Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch, and much more than Jihad Watch. His new book, Anti-Semitism, History and Myth, is coming out at least on Amazon in hardcover on March 18th. It's available on Kindle as well. And Robert, you mentioned that you've written another book. Can you tell us anything about that besides the two sentences that you gave us earlier?
It's called The Tragedy of Islam, Failure and Excuses. And like I say, it won't be out for another year because it was supposed to come out this fall and it got bumped because I'm about halfway through now with another book on the rape gangs in Britain and the response to them and the capitulation of Britain to jihad. And that will be out in the fall instead. That one is as yet untitled, but you'll be hearing more about it. Meanwhile, The Tragedy of Islam that is all finished and will be out in a year or so, that one is, like I say, it's about how Islam has proven over 14 centuries to be a failure for individuals and communities. It doesn't make individuals' lives better, and I've got a lot of profiles in the book of converts to Islam who end up becoming terrorists. And it is no good for societies. And I sketch out in the book what I explained to you gentlemen earlier about how the Ottoman Empire fell because it depended upon the income from the non-Muslims. And when the non-Muslims were no longer wealthy enough to be able to sustain it, then it went into decline.
That's going to be fascinating. And it's going to
Yes.
be, unbelievable. All right. I think at least I'm flagging, folks. I'm about 6 hours ahead of Robert and JJ Sefton. So I'm and I just
Right.
got off a
And
plane yesterday morning, so I'm going to wrap this one up. Our guest has been Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch, and as I said, much more. Buy his new book, Anti-Semitism, History and Myth. Robert, thank you very much for joining us. I know that you're quite busy, but I've been chatting with JJ Sefton for at least a couple of months about trying to get you on because your perspective on Islam is unique. I don't know of any other commentator who is as honest and forthright and able to cut through the nonsense that the West is cloaking itself in about Islam. So just for that, you are much appreciated and an invaluable resource for Western culture.
thank you very much, and always good to talk to you guys. Appreciate it.
Sefton?
You bet. Robert, yes, for CBD, it's JJ Sefton here, and for the great and invaluable Robert Spencer, thank you so much, and we wish you all the best. And I know you've been under the weather a little bit, so hopefully you will recuperate and have a nice, as long as we're talking about anti-Semitism, have a nice bowl of matzo ball soup, dear Lord. That's what you need. I could send it to you, I would. But in any event, with what's going on in the world, we can hope for better days. We can hope for the ascendancy of some sanity, whether it's reflected in the elections in Europe and elsewhere. And unfortunately, sadly, with the tragedies that are befalling so many places in the West, and of course in the state of Israel, hopefully people are waking up and waking up to the madness around them before it's too late. So for CBD and the great Robert Spencer, please check out jihadwatch.org. If that's wrong, we'll correct that. But also, please read him. He's over at frontpagemag.org and .com. And for CBD and Robert Spencer, it's JJ Sefton. Thank you so much for listening, for supporting us, and hitting the tip jar. And we will see you again real soon on the next one. God bless you all.
Thanks for listening, folks.